Okay, everybody. We're doing another sound check. Could you let us know how things are coming through?
Testing 789. Testing 789.
Could you let us know how the sound is doing? Because we're going to be starting. We want to make sure y'all can hear. Everybody happy? All right, everybody's happy.
Is everybody happy?
Okay, here goes. One, two, three. Shalom, everybody, and welcome to this week's Midrash on the Triennial Torah Portion Readings, which this week consists of Genesis in chapter 24, Isaiah chapter 51, verses 1 and 2, Psalm 18, and from the Brit HaShoah, or the Renewed Covenant, Ephesians chapter 5, verses 15 through 33. Leading us in our studies for this week is Mark Petrone of Fulfilling Torah Ministries. Because we did not read in our Sabbath service, we are going to review for you what Genesis chapter 24 says. And first, we're going to read verses 1 through 5. Verses 1 through 5. Genesis chapter 24. Abram was old and well stricken in age, and Yahweh had blessed Abraham in all things. And Abraham said unto his eldest servant of his house, that ruled over all that he had, put, I pray thee, thy hand under my thigh, and I will make you swear by Yahweh, the Elohim of heaven, and the Elohim of the earth, that you will not take a wife unto my son of the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I dwell, but you shall go unto my kindred and to unto my country and to my kindred, and take a wife unto my son Isaac. And the servant said to him, peradventure the woman will not be willing to follow me unto this land. Must I needs bring thy son again unto the land from whence you came? Mark is going to take it from here and direct our thoughts and studies on Genesis 24. Mark?
Shalom, homies. How you been? This is Mark. Time to go. I want to apologize to you all right up front, right now, because I only had like 4 hours to work on this week, so there isn't a whole lot here from me. But there is a whole lot in the Torah and the Haftarah today. So, Bereshit 24, verses 1 through 5. By the way, before we get there, do you remember the name of the servant who would be Abraham's heir in chapter 15?
Eliezer.
Eliezer. That's correct. That was a lot of years ago from our place in chapter 24 here. And this servant is not that one who was named Eliezer. There are a few characters named Eliezer in the scripture, but I know two who you probably don't know or never thought of. Yeshua's friend Lazarus, his name was Eliezer. And the Lazarus that Yeshua spoke of in Luke chapter 16, his name was also Eliezer, if you talking in Hebrew. The name means God of help, and Yahweh most certainly was a help in Bereshit 15 and would be here. He was to Lazarus as well. He was a help to Lazarus in Luke 16, who died in his poverty and went to be in Abraham's bosom. Do you suppose that was the 15? Could be. Couldn't know for sure, but I wouldn't put it past Yeshua to use a real person in that parable. And he was definitely a help to Yeshua's friend who was resurrected in John 11. At any rate, by now, Abraham is 140 years old, and it doesn't look like Yitzhak will ever be married. So Abi sends his servant, not Eliezer, to Mesopotamia to find a wife for his son from among Abi's kin. Now, most Christian commentators anyway, I'm not sure if it's the same in Judaism, but most Christian commentators will say that this servant was Eliezer. The Mishnah says that too. Okay, well, it's a possibility, but this is some 41 years after that fact. And so I don't see how that, well, it may be, but it Abraham's still alive, that's true. Okay, well, could be. Anyway, I think it's safe to assume that Avi was not pleased with the choices of Ishmael's for wives, and he wanted to ensure that Izzy didn't make the same kind of mistake. So Avi sent Eliezer to his family to find a Gentile bride for Izzy. Was Izzy dizzy? No, I don't think so. Kind of reminiscent of Abba calling out a Gentile bride for his son, Yeshua HaMashiach, the Melech HaYehudim. We were talking about that today. Somebody said that Yahweh is what was on the sign that was on the cross over Yeshua. One of the translations was Yud Heh Vav Heh, Yeshua HaNotzre, the Melech HaYehudim. Yeah, correct. So anyway, in this episode in Israel's history, Abraham represents Yahweh Avinu, who sends his servant to find a bride for his only begotten son. Yitzhak represents Yeshua HaMashiach, the bridegroom, and Rivka represents the Kahal, the believing Israel, the whole house of Jacob, and the bride and wife of Yahweh. Rivka comes to love Yitzhak before she ever sees him due to the faithful witness of Eliezer, who represents the Ruach HaKodesh. In verse 5, Eliezer makes a valid point. What if the girl doesn't want to leave her family to marry someone sight unseen? Should I then come and take Yitzi with me? Now it's Yitzi, it's not Izzy now. Now it's not Izzy anymore, it's Yitzi, okay? Should I come back and take Yitzi with me? Rivka most certainly represents believers here who must choose Yeshua sight unseen, no chance to go and see him, or that he'll come to show himself to us. We must step out in faith that he is who and what the faithful witness describes him to be. Avi's answer is telling. In today's vernacular, he would have said, "No way, dude. My son will not go back to the land from which we have crossed over in faith. If she won't follow, that's cool. I'll understand, and there's no one there who can walk in faith, and Yitzi will be better off. We'll try again later. However, Yahweh told me to send for a bride for my son, and he will see to it that you don't come back empty-handed. As Rivka did, so do we, taking the name of him whom we've never seen, but only heard of." At that point, I'm going to... That's not... Well, it was like today's vernacular like 30 years ago, dude. Best I can do, you know? So, questions or comments up to this point?
Anybody here in the congregation or in Pal Talk? Thoughts, questions, comments? Bill?
I have a little bit here. I believe that Abraham in his old age was very anxious to see his son marry. And I think it was natural in his position as a pastoral chief to be interested in the honor of the tribe. And I believe that more so as a patriarch who had regards to the divine praise of a numerous posterity, that he wanted this thing done probably before he died. And he knew that Yahweh would be faithful to him, and his desire was to see that come to pass, that his son would be married.
In Genesis, in chapter 24, in verse 4, "But you shall go unto my country and to my kindred and take a wife unto my son Isaac." Therefore, we see that the bride for Isaac was taken from among the kindred or the family of Abraham. And we're told in Romans chapter 4, verse 16, that Abraham is the father of our faith. And so, the bride of Messiah is taken from among the family of Abraham. And I have in my book, "Who is the Bride of Messiah?" one chapter that is dedicated to Genesis chapter 24. And developing the concept that the bride of Messiah is not every believer in Messiah, but is taken from among the family of the Messiah. And, you know, I just saw something here that I've never seen before, and that is this bride was for Isaac. Isaac represents Zion redeemed in the end of days, right? And what does it tell and say about Zion redeemed? Zion redeemed is likened to a wedding. In Jeremiah, in chapter 33, verses 10 and 11, thus says Yahweh, again there shall be heard in this place, which you say shall be desolate, without man, without beast, even in the cities of Judah, in the streets of Jerusalem that are desolate, without man, without habitant, without beast. The voice of joy, the voice of gladness, the voice of the bridegroom, and the voice of the bride. The voice of them that will say, praise Yahweh of hosts, for Yahweh is good, and his mercy endures forever. And of them that shall bring the sacrifice of praise into the house of Yahweh. Now look, it's talking marriage talk, then it says, for I will cause to return the captivity of the land as at the first, says Yahweh. So the returning of the captivity of the land is likened unto a marriage. Now, if we go to the book of Isaiah in chapter 62, verse 1, for Zion's sake will I not hold my peace, and for Jerusalem's sake I will not rest, until the righteousness thereof goes forth as brightness, and salvation as a lamp that burns. And the Gentiles shall see thy righteousness, and all the kings your glory, and you will be called by a new name, which the mouth of Yahweh shall name. You will be called by a new name. You will also be a crown of glory in the hand of Yahweh, a royal diadem in the hand of your Elohim. You will no more be termed forsaken, neither shall your land any more be termed desolate, but your land shall be called Hephzibah. And Hephzibah means my delight is in her, and your land Beulah, or married. For Yahweh delights in you, and your land shall be married. For as a young man marries a virgin, so shall your sons marry you. And as a bridegroom rejoices over the bride, so shall your Elohim rejoice over you. Therefore, Zion redeemed is likened unto a marriage and the taking of a bride. And in Psalm 126, and verses 1 and 2, the captivity of Zion is likened unto Isaac. Psalm 126, verses 1 and 2. When Yahweh turned again the captivity of Zion, we were like them that dream. Then our mouth was filled with laughter. The word laughter there is Yitzhak. So Yitzhak is associated with Zion redeemed, which is associated with a marriage. So Genesis chapter 24, Abraham is seeking for a bride for Isaac. In other words, this is Zion redeemed. And in seeking after that bride, we have that question. What if, verse 5, peradventure the woman will not be willing to follow me unto this land? Where is the land that Zion redeemed is to return to? The Beulah land, to the land promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So notice that Zion is asked, are you willing to come with me and follow me to this land? And now we haven't gotten there yet. But in verse 8, if the woman will not be willing to follow you, then you will be clear from this oath. Only bring not thy son thither again. So, it's the one who is willing to follow is the one that will accept the the invitation for the marriage. And that is Zion redeemed, looking at it in that aspect. But we're also looking at, from the body of Messiah itself, we are looking at a remnant within the body. Could you grab a mic if you have something to say? Grab a mic and share with us your thought, question, or comment.
The question I have is, the land that he sent for, was that Sumeria? Is that where he sent
the land was back in Mesopotamia.
I'm not exactly sure where. Or
closer to Haran, where Abraham left Ur and he went north to Haran, and that's where he and Lot left from. So it was in that neighborhood there.
But notice, Abraham didn't want a wife from the daughters of the Canaanites. Therefore, he didn't want the seed of Abraham to be intermingled with those who would turn Abraham's seed away from worship of the true God of Israel, which is what the Canaanites would do. Likewise, we are not to take of ourselves a quote-unquote wife that will turn our hearts away from the God of Israel and his ways. And that wife could be anything that we desire. It could be materialism or any form of idolatry that or sin that we take upon ourselves, and we become one with that wife. So Mark outlined here Abraham, a type of God the Father, Yitzhak, not only a type of Zion, but a type of the Messiah. And then Eliezer the servant, type of the Ruach. And we will continue the understanding here as we progress. Now, does anyone else in the congregation have any further thoughts, questions, comments? Teresa? I think we did through verse 5 so far.
No, we actually went through verse 9 in my notes.
Okay, well, let's... I only read through verse 5. Let's read through verse 9. Abraham said unto him, "Beware that you bring not my son thither again. Yahweh Elohim of heaven, which took me from my father's house and from the land of my kindred, which spake unto me and that sware unto me, saying, unto your seed will I give this land. He shall send his angel before you, and you will take a wife unto my son from there. And if the woman will not be willing to follow you, then you should be clear from this oath. Only bring not my son thither again." And the servant put his hand under the thigh of Abraham his master, and swear to him concerning that manner. Your next portion, Mark, goes through what verse? Beginning in verse 10. You actually go through the end of the chapter? Okay. So it goes through verse what? 41? Okay.
Eddie.
Yeah.
Before you go on, the part about it says put your hand on the thigh has to do with I have it here someplace. It's a token of subjection. That if he would do that, then he was subject unto Abraham to do this that Yahweh had told him to do. I don't know if anybody knew what that meant or not, but that's what it means.
Okay, go ahead.
Didn't they have the tassels on the thigh too? Would he put his hand on that? Would that be part of the oath?
I don't know. The tzitzit were not commanded until in the Numbers chapter 15.
Well, it is a vow. He's taken a vow and a covenant that, just like circumcision was linked with the loins, this vow is linked with the loins as well, because this has concern with offspring.
It does have to do with the seed. Years ago, I taught chapters 22, 23, and 24 for like 13 or 14 weeks at a Sunday school situation. And here, what he was doing when Abraham told him to put your hand under my thigh, you know, without getting too graphic, he was testifying by putting his hands on his testicles. That's what he was doing. And he's saying, by this I swear. That's what it was.
TMI.
Well,
right.
You guys said go ahead and tell me what I have studied. So,
well, I said
that's what it was. That's where the word testify. Well, that's where the word testify. I'm a medical person. I can't help it. That's where the word testify comes from. That's where we got the word. And he's saying, by everything that you are, as far as your family and your descendants, I will do this. That's why it says he put his hand under the thigh of his master and swore or testified concerning this matter. That's exactly what was going on.
And once again, I repeat, along the same concept or principle is the reason why the circumcision is of the flesh. Because it represents your being. Your being, your life. Your being, your life, your seed. And so this is how biblical vows were made, because today we say with all your heart. The way all your heart was represented was all your life being. Anybody else? Thoughts, questions, comments? We have a Pow Talk question. So the bride comes from a special line of the family? Yes. The bride is a subpart of the family of the Messiah. And so another question, is Jerusalem the bride spoken of in Revelation 21, verses 9 and 10? The Hebraic thought is there's a unity, a oneness between the people, the land, the covenants. And so Zion redeemed is called Jerusalem. Jerusalem is the bride. And in the Bible, a covenanted people, Zion, is called a city not forsaken.
Right, that speaks of the Jerusalem that is above, not the one that now is.
Right. So
okay.
So Zion is Jerusalem. Zion, Jerusalem is as adorned as a bride. Jerusalem is a city, and the covenant people of Yahweh is likened unto a city. Therefore, it's the people of Yahweh redeemed who will live in the new Jerusalem for all eternity, who is the bride, and they're dwelling in the city of the bride, which is the new Jerusalem. Now, in historical Jewish wedding customs, the bride was able to choose where she wanted to live, and the bridegroom had to provide that place for her. And of course, any sensible woman is going to choose the best place for her home, and that best place was understood to be Jerusalem. So Jerusalem is the city of the bride. So Hebraically, the city, the bride, and the land are all one. They're a unity with each other.
Yeah, and we're going to get to this next week when we do the Midrash, but since the question came up, I'll touch on it briefly. Is the bride a subgroup of believers? Yes.
Yes.
And we see this in that, as Eddie was saying, Abraham sends his servant to get us a bride from his own people, but also this bride, we'll see next week, she's chosen, and then she has the choice to say, yes, I'll go, or no, I won't. And her family doesn't want to let her go. In other words, the other believers around her don't want to let her go. And they say, let her stay here for a few days, maybe 10. Why? Because at Yom Teruah, we are called out, There are 10 days through there of tribulation and trials and persecution, of wandering in the wilderness. And then after that, on the 10th day, Yeshua comes. The bride will have gone out the 10 days prior. We will have lived in the wilderness, and we will be there on that mount to meet him when he comes. And everyone around us of the believing community will think we're crazy and that we should stay with them to see how things are going to play out. And the answer is no, I will go with this one.
Okay. There's a comment in Pow Talk that says, so the city on a hill in Matthew chapter 5, verse 14 is Zion. I believe the answer is yes. It says, you are the light of the world. A city is set on a hill, cannot be hid. The city is Jerusalem. Jerusalem is Zion. Now, let's see what it says about this city that is set on a hill. Let your light shine before men, that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven. Notice the city set on the hill is, which we are supposed to be as people, is to glorify your Father which is in heaven. Now, the purpose of the nation of Israel, it is through the nation of Israel that the Messiah is glorified. It says in Isaiah 44, verse 23, sing, O ye heavens, for Yahweh has done it. Shout, ye lower parts of the earth. Break forth into singing, ye mountains, O forests and every tree. For Yahweh has redeemed Jacob. He's glorified himself in Israel. Redeemed Jacob, glorified himself in Israel. Isaiah chapter 49, verse 3. And he said to me, you are my servant, O Israel, in whom I will be glorified. The city set on the hill was supposed to show good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven. Israel is supposed to give glory to the God of Israel, and they give glory to him when they keep his commandments, when they proclaim the Messiah, and when they are redeemed from exile. And so, yes, city set on the hill, Matthew chapter 5, verse 14, is Zion. And so, we have those who are a part of the family of Messiah, who's not the bride, will be the guests of the wedding party. Okay? Anybody else have any thoughts? Questions, comments. Another question in Pow Talk. So Torah going forth from Zion in Isaiah chapter 2 verse 3 is light coming out the city on a hill of Matthew chapter 5 verse 14.
Yes, sir.
The answer is yes. You see what happens when you get your right foundation, how you can link things together? Yeah. Okay, so back to Genesis in chapter 24, we are going to be reading in verse 10. It says, and the servant took 10 camels of the camels of his master and departed, for all the goods of his master were in his hand, and he arose and he went to Mesopotamia, under the city of Nahor. And he made his camels to knee down without the city by a well of water at the time of the evening, the time that women go out to draw water. Mark, I'm going to let you begin, but there's some powerful things to comment here. But no, I think in order to finish the story of the camels, I need to continue on. It says, O Yahweh, Elohim of my master Abraham, I pray thee, send me good speed this day and show kindness unto my master Abraham. Behold, I stand here by the well of water, and the daughters of the men of the city come out to draw water. And let it come to pass that the damsel to whom I shall say, let down thy pitcher, I pray thee, that I may drink, and she will say, drink, and I will give your camels drink also. Let the same be she that you have appointed for thy servant Yitzhak, and thereby shall I know that you have showed kindness unto your master. And it came to pass, before he had done speaking, that behold, Rebekah came out, who was born to Bethuel, son of Milcah, the wife of Nahor, Abraham's brother, with her pitcher upon her shoulder. And the damsel was very fair to look upon, a virgin, neither had any man known her. And she went down to the well, and filled her pitcher, and came up. And the servant ran to meet her, and said, let me, I pray thee, drink a little water of your pitcher. And she said, drink, my lord. And she hastened, and let down her pitcher upon her hand, and gave him drink. And when she had done giving him drink, she said, I will draw water for your camels also, until they have done drinking. And she hastened, and emptied her pitcher into the trough, and ran again into the well to draw water, and drew for all the camels. And the man wondering at her held his peace, to wit, whether Yahweh had made his journey prosperous or not. And it came to pass, as the camels had done drinking, that the man took a golden earring of half a shekel weight, and two bracelets for her hands, and 10 shekels weight of gold, and said, whose daughter are you? Tell me, I pray thee, is there room in your father's house for us to lodge in? And she said, I am the daughter of Bethuel, the son of Milcah, which she bare unto Nahor. She said, moreover unto him, we have both straw and provender enough, and room to lodge in. And the man bowed down his head and worshipped Yahweh. And he said, blessed be Yahweh Elohim of your master Abraham, who was not left destitute, my master, of his mercy and his truth. I being in the way, Yahweh led me to the house of my master's brother. And the damsel ran and took them of her mother's house these things. And Rebekah had a brother, and his name was Laban. And Laban ran out unto the man under the well. And it came to pass, when he saw the earrings and the bracelets upon his sister's hands, and when he had heard the words of Rebekah his sister, saying, thus spake the man unto me, that he came unto the man, and behold, he stood by the camels at the well. He said, come in, you blessed of Yahweh, wherefore stand thou without? For I have prepared the house and room for the camels. And the man came into the house, and he ungirded his camels, and gave straw and provender for the camels, and water to wash his feet and the men's feet that were with him. And there were set meat before him to eat. But he said, I will not eat until I have told my errand. And he said, speak on. And he said, I am Abraham's servant, and Yahweh has blessed my master greatly. He has become great. He has given him flocks and herds and silver and gold, men servants, man servants, and camels and donkeys. And Sarah, my master's wife, bare a son to my master, whom she was when she was old, and unto him has he given all that he has. And my master made me swear, saying, you shall not take a wife to my son of the daughters of the Canaanites, in whose land I dwell, but you will go unto my father's house, to my kindred, and take a wife unto my son. And I said unto my master, peradventure the woman will not follow me. And he said unto me, Yahweh, before whom I walk, will send his angel with you, and prosper your way, and you will take a wife for my son of your kindred of my father's house. Then shall you be clear from this my oath when you come to my kindred, and if you will not, and if they give not thee, you will be clear of this oath. Mark.
Thank you. I will probably go a little bit further than that, because I thought I was covering the whole chapter, and as I said, I didn't have a whole lot of time, so I got just touched on most of this stuff. Anyway, Eliezer took 10 camels. Do you suppose there's a reason he chose? He was, you know, that he took 10. Why was he led to take 10 camels? Is there a significant number?
Yes, 10 has different meanings. It's ordinal perfection. It's called another new first after the digit 9. It's numerous. It has with numerations commencing something that's going to happen anew.
Okay.
There could be a couple meetings. 10
might
in
have
Judaism
something to do with tribes, maybe?
Represents a legal congregation. A minyan consists of 10 men. So in other words, he's taken a wife from the body of Messiah, from 10, from a legal congregation. That could be one meaning. Another meaning is Zion redeemed is the gathering of the 10 tribes from the nations of the world unified with Judah. And so this could be a reference, possibly, maybe, potentially, to the 10 tribes.
The other thought was that if you split the 10 to 5, 5 is the number of grace, and there was a double portion of grace that was given here also. And the thought was that possibly that 5 of the camels held the gifts and the presents for the bride.
Okay, continue on if you want.
Okay. He went by caravan. By the way, all those things make a lot of sense, and I just asked the question. I was looking for an answer, and I got them. Okay. He went by caravan as the wilderness was crawling with crooks. No one, and I mean no one, crossed the eastern wilderness alone. Even the Magi came by a caravan to witness the Messiah's arrival for the same reason. When he got to Haran, he set out his plan to Yahweh and asked that he bless it. Well, he did, for everything went just as Eliezer asked. He was so excited about it that he wouldn't even eat until he was able to tell Laban and Bethuel. In verse 30, we see Laban's motive, gold fever. This particular lust consumed him, it would seem, for when Yaakov was looking for a wife, Laban deceived him for profit. Anyway, in Genesis chapter 24, 30 and 31, it says, "And it came to pass, when he saw the earring and bracelets upon his sister's hands, and when he heard the words of Rivka his sister, saying, Thus spake the man unto me, and he came unto the man, and behold, he stood by the camels at the well." So he sees the gold earrings, the gold bracelets, and he sees all these camels laden with all the stuff. And he says, I want that for me. Okay? He said, "Come in, thou blessed of Yahweh. There, wherefore standest thou without? Oh, I can't wait to take care of you. I'm really going to take care of you if I get a chance, I think. Anyway, for I have prepared the house and room for the camels." Laban wanted all of this loot for himself, I think. And he proves later that he is not a man of character. In reading between the lines, in verse 55, told you I was going to touch on this, we can see that Laban and his mother are schemers. "Let the damsel abide with us a few days, say 10, and then we'll let her go." But Eliezer would have none of it. "Sorry, I left a cake in the oven. It's my night to wash my hair. I really must be getting back." That's a Mark paraphrase. So they thought, well, maybe Rivka will allow us to rip this guy off a bit before she goes. So they said, well, we'll let her talk, decide. However, Rivka was on to her family's scheming and couldn't wait to get out of Dodge.
What Dodge?
Haran.
The Dodge Caravan?
The Dodge Caravan. The Dodge Caravan, that's right. Even though they understood that Rivka had seen through their ruse and they as much as threw her out of town in verse 59, she was still his sister, and they bestowed a great blessing on her, the general blessing on her. Funny thing is, she has become a mother of literally billions through the diaspora of Israel into the nations of the world. As I stated previously, Rivka left the familiar to step out in faith toward the unfamiliar, just as every believer in Yeshua as Messiah has done. While she was in the way, Yitzhak was out in the well of Lahairoi, the God who sees me. He lives and sees me. He lifted up his eyes and he saw his bride coming to be with him, led by the Ruach HaKodesh, and he started out to meet them. This kind of pictures the catching away of believers just before the end of the age. I believe there will be a rapture, but it won't be a pre-tribulation in its timing. When Rivka saw her bridegroom coming, she immediately got off the unclean animal. This is a picture of the bride. She was riding on a camel. This is a picture of the bride of Messiah separating herself from her uncleanness in our lives and unto the bridegroom before we go to him, to be with him. Yitzhak taking Rivka to his mother's tent is like the Kahal, both Jew and Gentile, being grafted into the root of Israel. So the representations in this chapter are Abe equals Abba, Yitzhak equals Yeshua, Eliezer equals Ruach, Rivka equals the Kahal, the church, Sarah equals the Commonwealth of Israel, and her tent equals the root or the vine of Yisrael. Salvation is individual in the Peshat and national in the Sod. National Israel right now is spiritually dead, but they will be resurrected after Yaakov's trouble. That's all I've got on Genesis 24.
Okay, I have a few thoughts. And it says the servant took 10 camels, and he made his camels to kneel down without the city by well of water. And the camels are going to represent burden bearing. You see, Zion redeemed has gone through quite a bit of trials, afflictions, persecutions, has had to endure a great many burdens, trials, tribulations. And then it says, he made his camels to kneel down without the city by a well of water. By a well of water. The Torah is likened unto a spring of water. So therefore we see here the significance and the significance of the bride returning to the well of water. That's returning to the Messiah, having the Spirit outpoured upon her, and returning to Torah in the end of days. And it says, at the evening, at the time that women go out to draw water. And so it says in Hosea chapter 5, verse 15, regarding Jacob's trouble, in their affliction they will seek my face. And so that's the time you go to draw water, is in affliction. You seek the face of the God of Israel. And he says in verse 12, O Yahweh Elohim of my master Abraham, I pray thee, send me good speed this day and show kindness unto your master. Show kindness. This is the Hebrew word hesed. And this is how Zion is redeemed in the end of days. Isaiah chapter 54, verses 7 and 8. For a small moment have I forsaken you, but with great mercies will I gather you. In a little wrath I hid my face from you for a moment, but with everlasting kindness will I have mercy on you, says Yahweh your Redeemer. So in order to redeem Zion and to redeem that bride, Yahweh is showing kindness in the process. Kindness is comfort. Completely goes together, right? The comfort is the kindness. Grace. Right. And then verse 13, behold, I stand here by the well of water, and the daughters of the men of the city come out to draw water. And here in Isaiah in chapter 55, Isaiah chapter 55, verse 1, ho, everyone that thirsts, come to the waters. And he that has no money, come ye buy and eat. Come to the waters. And so here we see this taking place by a well of water with camels. That's a burden bearing with the water itself and with kindnesses.
Also, we see there in verse 13, as you just read, he's standing by this well of water, and it's the daughters of the men of the city that come out to draw water. The daughters of the men of the city are those who would be the bride. This isn't being, you know, it's just women per se, spiritually speaking. Spiritually speaking, these are the Rivkas. These are the men and women who will be the bride, the daughter of God, who will marry his son. They're the ones who will come out at even. They're the ones who will come out in the tribulation instead of hiding under the rocks, instead of saying, Lord, what did you do to me? This isn't what I signed up for. They are the ones who will go to the well looking for water, and they will run to him.
OK, Okay, now it says in verse 14, and let it come to pass that the damsel to whom I shall say, let down thy pitcher, I pray thee, that I may drink. And she shall say, drink, and I will give your camels to drink also. You see what she's doing? She's watering the camels. So in other words, she's a servant. She's a servant. And the bride of Messiah, which who's the greatest in the kingdom, is the servant of all. Let's see the purpose of the coming out of Egypt. In Exodus, in chapter 3 and verse 12, it says, he said, certainly I will be with you, and you, this will be a token unto you that I've sent you. When you've brought forth the people out of Egypt, you will serve Elohim upon this mountain. You will serve Elohim upon this mountain. Then we have in Leviticus chapter 25, verse 55, for unto me the children of Israel are servants. They are my servants, whom I brought forth out of the land of Egypt. I am Yahweh your Elohim. Then, in Matthew, in chapter 20, Matthew chapter 20, and beginning, Matthew chapter 20, and verse 20. Then came to him the mother of Zebedee's children with her sons, worshiping him and desiring a certain thing. And he said, what will you? And he said, grant that these my sons may sit, one on the right, the other on the left. That means ruling and reigning. One on the right, other on the left. And he says, verse 26, whoever will be great among you, let him be your servant. And whosoever will be chief among you, let him be your servant. Even as the Son of Man came not to be ministered unto, but to be a servant, and to give his life for a ransom for many. So therefore, we see the greatest is the servant. And what did the woman do here? She was a servant. She was willing to take the water and to feed the camels. And then it goes on to say, because we see here the bride is from among his people. We see that the bride is a burden bearer, makes it through tribulation, has mercy bestowed upon her. She's willing to drink. She drinks from the well of water, and also she's a servant. But continuing on, it goes on to say, the damsel was very fair to look upon, a virgin. Now, Zion redeemed is likened unto a virgin. We can see this in Jeremiah chapter 31 and verse 12. Therefore they shall come and sing in the height of Zion. Then shall the virgin rejoice in the dance, both the young man and old together. I will turn their mourning into joy. I will comfort them. Now, continuing on here, it says, the servant ran to meet her and said, let me, I pray thee, drink a little water of your pitcher. And she said, drink, my lord, and let down her pitcher upon her hand and gave him drink. And when she had done giving him drink, she said, I will draw water for your camels also until they are done drinking. And the man wondering at her held his peace, to wit whether Yahweh had made his journey prosperous or not. And it came to pass, as the camels had done drinking, and then we got the marriage symbolism there, with the earring of a half a shekel and two bracelets and 10 shekels of gold.
Interesting about the two bracelets. Could be an allusion to the two houses here.
Okay. And verse 27, he said, blessed be Yahweh Elohim of my master Abraham, who has not left destitute my master, has not left destitute my master. In other words, wasn't forsaken. Well, in Isaiah in chapter 62, when it talks about Zion redeemed, this is what it says about Zion redeemed. It says that she will be called a city that is not forsaken. Isaiah in chapter 62, verse 12. They will call them the holy people, the redeemed of Yahweh. They will be called sought out, a city not forsaken. They'll be called a city not forsaken. So it says in verse 27, who has not left destitute my master of his mercy and his truth. Not destitute of his truth. What is truth? Psalm 119, verse 142, thy righteousness is an everlasting righteousness, and your Torah is truth. Psalm 119, verse 151, all your commandments are truth. So you've not left your servant destitute of mercy, that's grace, and truth. So therefore, the bride of Messiah is walking in Torah, but also has the mercy of Yahweh granted upon her, because she's been forgiven of her sins, and she has been redeemed from the nations of the world by the grace or the mercy or the chesed of the God of Israel. And I can't remember which verse it is now, but I believe there's a verse that she ended up taking the pitchers of water, put them on her shoulder. Okay, that's the picture. The shoulder represents government. So the bride, redeemed, is going to carry that pitcher of water upon her shoulder, meaning that she's going to rule and reign with the Messiah in his kingdom when he comes and sets it up.
Also, we see here that when she went down to the well of water, the spring of water, she filled her jar. She didn't just get enough for herself. She got enough for anyone who was in need. When that day comes, we need to have more than what we need. Because there will be those who will come to us saying, can you help me? And if we're running around saying, I don't know what's going on, or I can't do what I need to do, we can't help them. Especially those of us in the Hebraic Roots movement now. We're being called out and we're being trained by the hand of Yahweh to meet those needs. And I need to make sure that every time I go to that spring, we come with our jar full so that there's enough for someone else.
Genesis 24, verse 15. It came to pass before he had done speaking that, behold, Rebekah came out with her pitcher upon her shoulder. That's where the upon the shoulder represents government authority. Now, notice something else here. He prays a prayer. He said in verse 12, O Yahweh Elohim, my master Abraham, I pray thee, send me good speed this day and show kindness. That's his prayer. And then it says, verse 15, it came to pass before he had done speaking. He's not even able to get the prayer completed, and boom, it is answered. That is also a characteristic of Zion redeemed. If we go to Psalm 102 and verse 13, it says, you will arise and have mercy upon Zion, for the time to favor her, yea, the set time has come. And it says in verse 17, he will regard the prayer of the destitute and not despise their prayer. Who's the destitute? Zion. This shall be written for the generation to come. The people that shall be created shall praise Yahweh. So he's hearing the prayer of Zion as soon as Zion prays the prayer. Then in Isaiah in chapter 30. Isaiah chapter 30, verse 8. Go write it before them on the table and note it in a book that it may be for the time to come forever and ever. And so, the Holy One of Israel, Isaiah chapter 30, verse 12, who is Yeshua the Messiah, is telling Isaiah to write something down in a book for the generation or for the time to come. And that can be rendered from the Hebrew, the final generation. And then it goes on to say in verse 19, regarding the final generation, and Zion redeemed as a part of that final generation, for the people shall dwell in Zion at Jerusalem, shall weep no more. He will be very gracious unto you at the voice of your cry. When he shall hear it, he will answer you. He hears the cry of Zion as soon as it comes out of her mouth and answers the prayer. That's exactly what happened here. He said, I pray that you'll show mercy. And before he had finished, Rebekah is there. So, this chapter is a foreshadowing of the bride of Messiah in Zion redeemed in the end of days. Because why? The whole Bible is about exile in redemption.
Eddie?
Yeah, we just happened to find it again. Okay, Bill.
If you'll notice in 35 and 36, there's 12 ands. It has to do with government perfection, of which the 12 tribes would make a perfect government of under which Yahweh would rule. So there's, and this also has to do with the wealth of Abraham. It tells his whole wealth right here, and it's an earth, the earthly gifts, the earthly things that he had. But on the other hand, it could also represent the spiritual things, the spiritual kingdom that's coming.
This is a very powerful chapter, teaching us so many principles, so many things, and we probably missed more than what we have even shared so far. Teresa?
I'll throw one more real simple, basic one out there that's not too hard to see, but for people who are just seeing this for the first time, it'll be important. Two chapters ago in Genesis 22, we had the binding of Isaac. He was taken on Mount Moriah, and he had the wood on his shoulders, and he was about to be sacrificed when the ram shows up in the thicket by his horn. And Abraham comes back down. Now, when they went up, Abraham and Isaac left, and he looks at his two servants. He says, we will return. But we don't see Isaac returning. We see the father and the father alone. We don't see Isaac again for two chapters. Or in other words, 2,000 years is when we now see this son again. Why? Because the bride has been sent for, the bride has been called out, and now the bride and the son come together. But it's not until these two chapters later.
Anybody else in the congregation or in Pow Talk have further thoughts, questions, comments?
Your 12 ends.
Genesis 24, verses 1 through 41.
Bill, your 12 ends. What did you say that was all about?
It has to do with the governmental perfection. Also, it has to, because the 12 tribes would have helped represent that, also represents the sum of the earthly possessions that Abraham had. Now, if you would add the extra and that it's above there in the verse before, then you would have 13 tribes, of which there really were.
Okay. Now, you know what and is in Hebrew. In Hebrew, and is the letter vav, and the letter vav represents a nail that sticks things together. So the idea here is that we have 12 tribes all stuck together. It's the way that I see it, anyway.
Anybody else have further thoughts, questions, comments regarding Genesis chapter 24, verses 1 through 41? Is there anybody either in the congregation or in Pow Talk land? Yes. here in the congregation.
Just a short comment that on verse 11 it says that this whole thing is happening at evening, which is an allusion to the end of days. The time,
right, because the tribulation is a time of evening, of darkness.
Yeah, so this is happening now, I think.
Right, so thank you. That's another connection to the end of days and the redemption of the exiles of Israel.
I think it's important to realize that when the servant saw, whoever the servant was, if the servant was Eleazar, when he saw her, he was probably struck by her beauty, because her name means captivating in the Hebrew.
Well, we're told about Zion redeemed that she's a bride, she's beautiful, and
represented by the Shulamite woman in Song of Solomon, who was a looker as well. Yes.
Okay. Anybody else have any further thoughts, questions, comments on the congregation or in Paltalk? We have what verses correspond to Genesis chapter 24 and verse 15? Well, it says her pitcher is upon her shoulder. Well, if we go to Isaiah and in chapter 9, Isaiah chapter 9 and verse 6, we see the following that is said. For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder. The shoulder represents government. Now, where was Joseph buried? Joseph was buried in Shechem, which means back or shoulder. And it says that they will all serve Yahweh with one consent. This is in Zephaniah chapter 3, verse 9. For I will turn the people a pure language, and they will all call upon the name of Yahweh to serve him with, the word consent in Hebrew is Shechem. Serve him with one Shechem, with one shoulder. So the shoulder represents government. It represents ruling and reigning. So those are going to be some of the scriptures that correspond to Genesis chapter 24, and verse 15. Anybody else in the congregation or in Paltalk have any further thoughts, questions, comments? We are still studying Genesis chapter 24 and verses 1 through 41.
This Laban who was there, is that the father of Leah and Rachel? It's the same person. Well, no wonder he was a little scrupulous. Unscrupulous.
Okay, I think there is some wants to repeat the scriptures about Yahweh answering the prayers of Zion when Zion cries out. Psalm 102 verses 13 through 16, and also Isaiah chapter 30 verse 19. I'm sure there's more, but there's a couple for you. Anybody else with further thoughts, questions, comments? We're in Genesis chapter 24, either in the congregation or in Paltalk. Well, let's go to our Haftorah, which is Isaiah in chapter 51 and verses 1 and 2. Hearken to me. Oh, thank you. Hearken unto me, you that follow after righteousness, you that seek Yahweh. Look unto the rock where you are hewn, into the hole of the pit where you are digged. Look unto Abraham your father, and to Sarah that bare you. For I called him alone, and blessed him, and increased him. For Yahweh shall comfort Zion. He will comfort all her waste places. He will make her wilderness like Eden, her desert like the garden of Yahweh. Joy and gladness shall be found therein, thanksgiving and the voice of melody. Mark.
Well, man, I only wanted the first phrase there, but that's okay. That was good. Okay. This is real brief. Remember the representations that I laid out in Genesis 24, where it says, I'm going to go over them again. Abe equals Abba. Yitzhak equals Yeshua. Eliezer equals Ruach. Rivka equals the Kahal. Sarah equals the Commonwealth of Israel. And her tent equals the root or the vine of Israel. Okay? Now, looking at this couple of verses here. If you're following after righteousness and seeking Yahweh, as it tells us in verse 1, look to Abi and Sarah, who alone among all the peoples of the earth, Yahweh called to follow him and to give Abraham a blessing of increase. Abraham alone was called. All believers are Abraham's physical and spiritual children who are blessed in him by his son, Yeshua. Abi's kids equals Zion in verse 3. That's really all I got, because
verse 1,
hearken,
which is Shema, you that follow after righteousness. Righteousness is obeying Yahweh, following His Torah, keeping
Shema
His commandments.
Shema means hear and obey.
Right. So you who are following Torah, look unto Abraham and Sarah. Well, if you who are following Torah, if you look unto Abraham and Sarah, what are you looking unto? The covenant that was made with Abraham and Sarah. In other words, you are believing and standing on that covenant. And then it says, Yahweh will comfort Zion. Yahweh is comforting Zion because Zion, or Zion in Hebrew, is standing on the covenant that was made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. In other words, they will be standing for the land. And those who have disregard for the covenant will have disregard for the land. And actually, that's what the test, or one of the tests, of Zion is, in the end of days, is it is a test, just like there were 12 spies that was sent to spy out the promised land. Basically, the test was, do you believe the covenant that was made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? That is the test. And those who will stand for the covenant will ultimately be Zion, whom Yahweh is going to redeem, and to show himself strong in the sight of all the nations. Now, what does it say about in Daniel in chapter 11 in verse 28? Then shall he return unto his land with great riches, and his heart shall be against the holy covenant. This is who we commonly refer to and think of as the false Messiah in the end of days. And what does it say then in verse 30 of Daniel 11? He will have indignation against the holy covenant. And what does it say in verse 32? He will do wickedly against the covenant. The answer is, what covenant? It's the covenant that was made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so the opposers of Zion come and attack the covenant, which means they come and attack the land. And in Isaiah 51, Yahweh comforts Zion because you're looking unto Abraham and Sarah. You're standing with the covenant. And so the battle is over the covenant. The enemy is attacking the covenant. Yahweh is standing for the covenant. Zion redeemed, who is a bride, will stand up for the covenant, and the Messiah will stand up for Zion on behalf of the covenant, because it's the Messiah who made the covenant with Abraham. Galatians chapter 3 and verse 16. Anybody have any further thoughts, questions, comments here about Isaiah 51?
The only comment that I have, because, I mean, it was rather short and it pretty much covered it, is the fact that everything that happens with Yahweh is a one-on-one experience. It can't happen any other way. It has to be one-on-one, and this is what happened to Abraham and the other patriarchs. He dealt with them on a one-on-one, and if you deal with a person one-on-one, usually if you listen, you're going to pay attention to what is being said. And I think that's partly what I see here also.
Well, this passage here and what Eddie was just speaking about reminds me of something, and I don't have the article to back me up. It's at home sitting on my printer. I was going to bring it today. You know, in the past, Eddie's talked about how something's got to give over in Israel for Zion to start to take formation. And he's talked about one of the possibilities is an uprising or a rebellion or a division within the Israeli army. And this week, as they started evacuating people from Hebron, there are reports coming out of Israel that there are soldiers who are defying orders and refusing to do so. For the first time, it's happening. So, you know, add that to what Eddie was talking about this morning in the five-minute update about how, you know, are we in the end of age? Well, that's just another witness or another sign. But they're starting to have a division where they're willing to say, I will defy orders rather than remove my brethren from their homes.
And because of what you just said is the ultimate reason why, when they come to remove Jews from their homes in the mountains of Israel, it will not be a task that the Israeli soldiers will be asked to do. It will be a task that will be assigned to international troops, the multinational forces. Yeah. By the way, does anyone have a calendar? Does anyone know when Hanukkah is this year? The early part of December?
Yeah, it's early in December. I think it does start the 8th.
Well, the interesting possibility now, if they keep their November date, is if they have a meeting in November, you could have a Hanukkah rebellion. Okay? We'll have to wait and see. Anybody else with further thoughts, questions, comments regarding Isaiah in chapter 51? Well, our reading from the Psalms is Psalm 19. It's six verses. Someone says it's December the 4th. Okay? Psalm 19, verses 1 through 6. The heavens declare the glory of Yahweh, and the firmament shows His handiwork. Day unto day utter speech, and night unto night showeth knowledge. There is no speech nor knowledge where their voice is not heard. Their line is gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the earth. In them has He set a tabernacle for the sun, which is as a bridegroom coming out of his chamber, and rejoices as a strong man to run a race. His going forth is from the end of heaven, and his circuit unto the ends of it, and there is nothing hid from the heat thereof. Mark.
Wow. Well, okay. All creation declares the majesty and righteousness of Yahweh, Melech Ha'olam, and it speaks out in every language under heaven. The stars and the constellations all declare the same gospel, as the star and the constellation names all translate the same from every language. If you study on the gospel and the stars, you will find that star names, constellation names, doesn't matter what language it is, they all mean the same thing, always, in every language. For example, Leo, the lion, in the Latin constellations, is also Ariel, the lion, in the Hebrew constellations. Let's see, what other one do I have here? Oh, Virgo in Latin is Virgo, the virgin. In Hebrew, it's Bethula, the virgin. Same thing, identical. Find this Taurus in Latin. The reem, the bull in, okay, always the same. So it goes on ad infinitum. For this reason, men are without excuse. The gospel is clearly seen in the creation, and they have been witnessed to, whether they have ever heard the name of Yahweh or the name of Yeshua with their ears. They've seen the gospel, and it can be known to them. Verses 4 and 5 remind me of Malachi 4, 1 and 2. Let's read those verses again. It says here, their line has gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. In them hath he set a tabernacle for the sun, which is as a bridegroom coming out of his chamber, and rejoiceth as a strong man to run a race. Malachi 4, 1 and 2, the Son of Righteousness comes. He'll bring fiery indignation on those who have persecuted his bride, and he'll bring healing in his wings. If you take heed to his word and live by it, you will be accepted in the beloved. That's as far as I'm going to go, because that's as far as we've read.
I thought 4 and 5 were very interesting also. When I looked up the line there means inheritance. It means their words or teachings from the Torah. In the Hebrew, it has to do with measuring or lotting or allotting line. And it says that Yahweh set a tabernacle for the sun. The signs of the zodiac are called the house of the sun, because in them he moves and dwells and completes his circuit. And this corresponds with Yahweh's servant dwelling and moving in the written word, completing their life's circuit. It has to do with obedience to him and doing what? Because we know that in the stars, that's what they had to go by originally, was the stars. And in the stars is the whole pattern of the 6,000 years, 7,000 years of history.
Okay, let's continue on in Psalm 19. We read the first six verses. The entire psalm is 14 verses. So verse 7, the Torah of Yahweh is perfect, converting the soul. The testimony of Yahweh is sure, making wise the simple. The statutes of Yahweh are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of Yahweh is pure, enlightening the eyes. The fear of Yahweh is clean, enduring forever. The judgments of Yahweh are true and righteous altogether. Those are verses 7 through 9. Mark has a thought on that.
Verses 7 through 9. There are six ways that the word of Yahweh is referenced in verses 7 through 9. The overarching one is Torah. It says there, the law of Yahweh is perfect. The Torah is perfect. And the subsets of that are given right afterwards. The testimonies, the statutes, the commandments, fear, and judgments. Okay? Now, 5 speaks to grace. The 1 speaks to Echad. Or oneness. Okay, so we're given all of that. We're given grace in these 5, and Torah is the one thing that holds it all together. Okay, that's all I've got for 7 through 9.
If you put the numbers together and make it 6, I believe that the Torah is described by 6 names here. The number of man made for man to follow. So it still works out 5 and 1.
Good.
Works out as 5 and 1 here.
Mark, you had me look up a word just a few minutes ago, which was mazor. And I didn't think much of it until you just commented on those verses. Because that ties the first part of the psalm together with the second part of the psalm. First off, I want to say regarding that verses 1 through 6 are exactly what Eddie was teaching during the teaching this morning, the 7,000-year plan of God. It's been in the heavens since the beginning, and it says that it runs its course, and it goes from the beginning to the end, and nothing's hidden. Okay, the matzor, or the stars in the heavens, come from a Hebrew word that literally means that which is bound up, or bound together. So the story of the 7,000-year plan is bound together, and that ties together what you were just saying here, because the Torah binds together the testimony, the precepts, the commandments, the fear, and the judgments. So you've got the same imagery in both parts of this psalm, and I didn't see that until you described
exactly
it the
right.
way
the
you
only
just
reason
did.
I asked for that is because the Hebrew vendera is called the Mazarot,
right.
And that is the sign of those things that are drawn together. So very cool. Very cool stuff.
Verse 7, the Torah of Yahweh is perfect. The word perfect is tamim, which means without blemish, undefiled, whole, or complete. Let's see a couple examples where this word tamim is found. It's in Exodus in chapter 12 and verse 5. It says, your lamb shall be tamim, without blemish. So, without blemish is a characteristic of the bride. The Torah is without blemish. Mark?
It says the Torah is tamim, converting the soul. It converts our soul from what it was to what Yahweh wants it to be. Tamim. Perfect. The Torah makes our souls perfect.
Okay, Joshua chapter 24 and verse 14. Now fear Yahweh and serve him in sincerity and in truth. Sincerity is tamim. So the way we serve Yahweh is with tamim and truth. Truth is Torah. So the Torah is tamim. So we serve him by following Torah. And then Psalm 119 and verse 1 says the following. It says, blessed are the undefiled, which is tamim, in the way who walk in the Torah of Yahweh. So the Torah of Yahweh is undefiled. It is without blemish. And those who follow the Torah are tamim. If that's what the Torah is and you're following Torah, then that's what you become. Now it says in the King James, converting the soul, but the Hebrew word is shuv, which means to repent or return.
Right, to turn it. To transform it.
Transforms the soul.
Oh,
the Torah
Romans chapter 12 and verse 2.
Right. The Torah transforms the soul because it's by knowledge of the Torah or the word of Yahweh, which is our light, that we see where we need to improve in our lives. Now it says, the testimony of Yahweh is sure. What's the testimony of Yahweh? It's the Torah. Making wise the simple. The Torah makes wise the simple. So who are the simple? It's those who are seeking to inquire knowledge of Torah. Psalm 119, verse 130, the entrance of your words give light, it gives understanding to the simple.
Simple, according to the way that Yeshua used the word, means someone who's got his mind stayed on one thing, in particular on the Torah. Okay? So if your eye is simple or single, looking towards the Torah, then your whole body will be filled with light, is what he said. And so I think that's where we're coming from here with simple. It makes wise those who are single-mindedly on the Torah.
Okay, now, Psalm 119, verse 130, the entrance of your words gives light, it gives understanding to the simple. The Torah gives understanding to the simple. Proverbs chapter 8, verse 5. O you simple, understand wisdom. O you simple, understand wisdom. So the simple are to progress to being wise, to walking in wisdom. Now the word simple is the Hebrew word pati, which is the Strong's number 6612. And it will correspond to the Greek word that's translated as bathes in Messiah, which in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 1, it says, I, brethren, could not speak unto you as spiritual or wise or wisdom, but as unto carnal, even as babes in Messiah. 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 1. And the Greek word babe is nepios or napios, and if you look that up, it will correspond to the Hebrew word pati or simple. Yeah. So the Torah takes the simple, and the simple partake of the milk of the word, the simple things of Torah, and it make by pursuing them, pursuing the Torah, it makes them wise and of understanding. So it's telling us that the Torah is mature, it's complete, it transforms our soul, and it makes us from just being simple to being wise. The statutes of Yahweh are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment is pure, enlightening the eyes. The fear of Yahweh is clean, enduring forever. The judgments of Yahweh are true and righteous altogether. More to be desired are they than gold, yea, than much fine gold, sweeter also than the honey and the honeycomb. You know, there's a song that is often sung in church. The law of the Lord is perfect, you know, converting the soul, the testimony. But I bet they didn't realize when they were singing that song that they were singing about following Torah. It says in verse 11, moreover, by them is your servant warned, and in keeping of them there is great reward. Notice, in keeping of Torah is great reward. In keeping of Torah is great reward. Now, if we go to Revelation in chapter 22, Revelation chapter 22, verse 12, I come quickly, and my reward is with me. Verse 14, blessed are they that do his commandments, that they may have right to the tree of life and may enter in through the gates of the city. So, keeping of Torah is of great reward. Who could understand his errors? Cleanse thou me from secret faults. Keep back your servant also from presumptuous sins. Let them not have dominion over me. Then shall I be upright, and I shall be innocent from the great transgression. Let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in your sight, O Yahweh, my strength and my redeemer. So, Bill, you have a thought?
Yeah, I tried to study this out a little bit, and here's what I got. The clearer our view of Yah's Torah, the more manifest are our sins. But in all this, to get its full effect, we need divine grace to show us our faults, to acquit us, to restrain us from the practice, and free us from the power of sin. And only in Yeshua is this possible. Nowhere else.
Okay, Mark, share with us.
One last little line here. The great transgression in verse 13 has to do with the apostasy in 2 Thessalonians in chapter 2. Okay, we keep away from that apostasy by taking heed unto Yahweh's word and doing it.
The great transgression is departing from Torah. Turning away from Torah.
Correct.
Which is turning away from the Messiah. Which is turning away from being led by His Spirit.
And when people do that, Yahweh will send them a strong delusion so that they'll believe any lie that they're told. It says all that in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Yeah, what Teresa just said. What you ask for, you will get. If you ask for Yahweh's righteousness, you will get Yahweh's righteousness. If you ask for a lie, He'll let you have it. He'll send it to you.
I don't know whether I gave the wrong scripture reference or not, or maybe someone misunderstood it, but it's Proverbs chapter 8, verse 5. O ye simple, understand wisdom. And I don't know whether I mentioned that correctly or not. Someone thought I may have said 28 verse 5, but it's Proverbs chapter 8 in verse 5. Did you have a thought?
Yeah, just about the Torah being tamim or perfect or unblemished. Yeshua, when he was the Passover lamb, he was also found without blemish. That's because he was the perfect lamb. And the Torah being the light, also Yeshua said, "I am the light." So when we believe in, when we claim that we believe the Mashiach, which is Yeshua, who is Yeshua, then it should follow that we embrace Torah, because he is the Torah, he is the law.
Okay. Anybody else have any thoughts, questions, comments regarding Psalm 19? Anybody else with thoughts, questions, comments regarding Psalm in chapter 19? If not, we'll go on to our Brit Hadashah portion, which is Ephesians in chapter 5 and verses 15 through 33, which says, "See then that you walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise, redeeming the time, because the days are evil. Wherefore be ye not unwise, but understanding what the will of Yahweh is. Be not drunk with wine, wherein is excess, but be filled with the Ruach, speaking to yourselves in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody in your heart to Yahweh, giving thanks always for all things unto Elohim and the Father in the name of Yahweh Yeshua HaMashiach, submitting yourselves one to another in the fear of Elohim. Wives, submit yourselves unto your husbands as unto..." Wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands as unto Yahweh. "For the husband is the head of the wife, even as Messiah is the head of the congregation, and he is the Savior of the body. Therefore, as the congregation is subject to Messiah, let the wives be to their own husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives, even as Messiah loved the congregation and gave himself for it, that he might sanctify and cleanse it with the washing of water by the word, that he may present it to himself a glorious congregation, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but it should be holy and without blemish. So ought men love their wives as their own bodies. He that loves his wife loves himself. For no man ever yet hates his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, even as Yahweh the congregation. For we are members of his body, of his flesh, and of his bones. For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother, shall be joined to his wife, and they two shall be one flesh. This is a great mystery, or so, deeper meaning, but I speak concerning Messiah and the congregation. Nevertheless, let every one of you in particular so love his wife, even as himself, and the wife see that she reverence her husband." Mark.
Love this passage of Scripture. I wish I had had some time to develop it. Boy, I'll tell you what, I could go for weeks on this. But anyway, I only had like an hour last night, so here we go. We also keep away, remember I was talking about apostasy a few minutes ago. We also keep away from apostasy by watching for signs of the times and for possible areas of weakness in our lives, and then building up our endurance by doing Yahweh's word. How many times am I going to say doing Yahweh's word? I'm going to do it all the time. "There is no better way to redeem the time, no other way to know the will of Yahweh for us, than by doing his word. Shaul follows the general with specific ways to ensure we are redeeming the time. He tells us to redeem the time, then he says, don't get drunk. Doesn't say don't drink alcohol, it says don't get drunk. It says be filled with the Spirit. It says speak righteousness to ourselves and others. Keep a grateful heart in you and submit to those who are your head." Okay? Husbands are supposed to submit to Yeshua. He is the head of the man. The wife is to submit to her own husband as he is submitted to Yeshua. Okay? He's the example that she is to follow. Okay? absolutely important that it's, wives, submit yourselves to your own husbands. That's why I stopped Eddie and had him read that again. So I wanted to make sure that own got in there. It doesn't say submit yourself to husbands. It says submit yourself to your own husbands. Teresa should not submit to me, even though I am a husband. But I ain't her husband. Thank goodness. Anyway, I'm not her husband, and so she should not submit to me. Now, okay, but she should submit to Tom, and she does. Same deal with Susie. She should not submit to me, but she should submit to Ronald. That is the proper way to go. In the same way, I don't submit to Eddie, except in places where he is in headship. There are certain areas where he is absolutely in headship here, and I have to follow his lead. However, he's not the guy in charge of my family. Yeshua is the guy in charge of my family, and I have to submit to him.
Also, in regard to that, as we see in verse 21, be subject to one another out of the fear and reverence of Messiah, then be subject to your own husbands, and the husband is the head of the wife. You know, it's one thing to say what Mark was just saying. It's very true. I don't submit to Mark. I respect Mark. I think Mark's an okay kind of guy, but I don't submit to him.
Is he right?
Sometimes. He's right until he disagrees with me. But that's another argument. But at the same time, husbands don't expect someone else's wife to submit to you. I've had situations where other people's husbands think I need to listen to them and to submit to them. And all that's going to do is get them in a lot of trouble. Because one, yeah. I would expect and hope that my husband's going to come up and say, wait a minute, that woman has nothing to do with you.
Right.
And two, for those who know me personally know, if Mark or any other husband in this congregation expects me to start submitting to them just because they're someone else's husband, I'm going to push back. And then it just gets ugly and spirals out of control, and that's the normal thing for people to do.
Right.
So it's so important, as Mark said, that it's to your own husband and to your own wife that you do these things.
This happened before my wife and I were married. We were hanging out with a couple of guys, and this one guy actually said to my wife, we weren't married yet, so she wasn't really in subjection to me. She was still in subjection to her father. However, she was spoken for. We were engaged. This guy said to her, this is a direct quote, submit, woman. And he said it in my presence. And I said, whoa, stop. Stop. First thing is, you're not married to her, so she doesn't have to submit to you. She has to submit to her father right now. If she's going to submit to anybody in this room, it's going to be me, because I am her betrothed. So back off. And it's just that thing has always stuck with me, and that's why I make sure that I point this out every time I get to this passage, because it is absolutely important. You don't have no man has any say over anybody else's wife. And that's just how that is. The pastor of a church has nothing to say about the wife.
That's what I was just going to comment on.
About the wife in another family.
There are other husbands, usually pastors, not always. I've had somebody else's husband who wasn't a pastor, thought he should be, who decided he needed to tell me when I could speak, when I couldn't speak, even to the clothes I should or shouldn't be wearing, which got real ugly. But the thing is, that's one of the things. People don't want to listen to people because of various people they work with. Let me tell you something. There are those listening who will not like what I'm going to say, but I'm going to say it anyway. Michael Rood. People don't like Michael Rood because he associates with the unsaved. Heaven forbid that we associate with the unsaved and give them the gospel. But Michael Rood, when you go into any one of his meetings, when you're on tour with him as a family, he will always say, I'm not in charge. First and foremost, Yahweh is in charge of this meeting. And second, and probably most important here, is husbands, fathers, you got a problem with what I say, you can get up and take your family out of here anytime. I am not over your family.
Yeah.
That's proper understanding of this. And that's important to remember.
Boy, Michael has a really good teaching about this.
Yes, he has a very good teaching over your spiritual authority and covering. But you never, ever subject, as a husband, as a father, your wife and your children to teaching that you know is not biblical. Because it's not that pastor or rabbi or teacher, whatever you're going to call them, who's responsible for that. It's you, as the head of the household, who will answer for what you subject your family to.
Now, most of the newer translations of the Scripture, the NIV comes to mind, the NASB comes to mind, take this passage and they say, submit yourselves to one another. Now, if I am going to submit to Bill, and Bill is going to submit himself to me, who's in charge? Okay? That remains to be said. Actually, I don't think so. I think you're bigger than I am. I'm a little taller than you. But you see, the Scripture says, submit yourselves one to another. There is a hierarchy that we need to follow, okay? The hierarchy in a family is Yeshua is the head, the father is the executive officer who makes sure that everything that Yeshua says goes, and the mother is the chief engineer. I put this in text earlier. You know, there's the CO, the XO, and the Cheng. It's a naval thing. The CO is in charge. He's the guy that plans and coordinates. The XO is the guy that actually executes the stuff, and the chief engineer is the guy that empowers it all. Okay, and that's the spirit. Okay. If everyone submitted to everyone else, there would be no upward direction. Unfortunately, that is the state of Christianity astray today. In reference to submitting one to another, the wife is to submit to her husband, and her husband, as her husband, is submitted to Yeshua. Human marriage is a picture of the relationship between the Messiah and the Kahal, as it says later on in the chapter here. Marriage is contrasted to the temple prostitution in the temple of Diana, which was in Ephesus. It's the whole point of this passage being in here. Okay? So that they could be... Now, those prostitutes would submit themselves to the priests of Diana so that they could be impregnated on Diana's altar on Easter Sunday. So that next year, on Easter Sunday, they would have babies to sacrifice on that altar. That's what the Diana worship was about. Okay? And that's what Paul is coming against big time in chapter 5 here in Ephesians. And that's just what we need to remember, that we're looking at a pagan place, Ephesus. And Diana of the Ephesians is what caused some of the troubles in Acts, you know? So you got to be very careful about how you submit and to whom you submit. That's all I've got.
For one moment, back to Psalm 19, verse 13, the word presumptuous, and as presumptuous sin, is the Hebrew word zed, which really means proud. And that word zed, or proud, is found in Psalm 119, verse 21, where it says, "You've rebuked the proud that are cursed, which do err from your commandments." Because we said that presumptuous sin is, of course, not following Torah. So we have a scripture there that uses that word in relation to not keeping or following the commandments of Yahweh. So now let's look at Ephesians chapter 5, verse 15. "See then you walk circumvently, not as fools, but as wise." Walk as wise, not as fools. Going back to Proverbs and in the Torah, what do the wise do? Follow Torah. Don't walk as fools. What do fools do? Fools forsake the Torah. So here Paul is saying to follow the Torah and redeeming the time. "Wherefore be not unwise." What is someone that's unwise? Someone that doesn't follow Torah. but understanding what the will of Yahweh is. If you know what the will of Yahweh is, it's following Torah. And don't be drunk with wine, but be filled with the Ruach. Speaking yourselves in psalms and spiritual songs, singing and making melody in your heart to Yahweh, giving thanks always for all things unto Elohim and the Father in the name of Yahweh Yeshua HaMashiach. Now, the Bible says that the joy of Yahweh is our strength. And so, we should have a song in our heart. There was an old song in the hymnals, "When morning gilds the skies, my heart awakening cries, may Jesus Christ be praised, may Yeshua HaMashiach be praised." And that should be our heart. When morning gilds the skies, we cry, may He be praised. And so, it's when you're walking in the Spirit and have a song in your heart, that's when you're able to walk in the Spirit. What are you doing if you have a song in your heart? You're praising Yahweh. And if you're praising Yahweh, you're not going to walk in the flesh. And so, submitting yourselves one to another in the fear of Yahweh. Wives, submit yourselves to your own husbands. Now, verse 23, the husband is the head of the wife, even as Messiah is the head of the body. And so, it's often quoted out of context, wives, submit to your husbands. What if your husbands aren't submitted to Yahweh? There's a problem. And it's because when we teach wives, submit to your husbands, when the husbands aren't submitted to Yahweh, that's when wives get frustrated and basically they rebel. And really, in truth, I believe the feminism women's movement is a result of a reaction of men not being responsible and fulfilling their godly role. And women got frustrated and responded in a rebellious way. And so it's the men must be submitted to Messiah, and if men are submitted to Messiah, then the wives can be submitted to their husbands, because in essence the wives are submitting to the Messiah. And that's also how when both husbands and wives are then in order submitted to the Messiah, That's what causes the children to be in order as well. And then it says for men to love their wives as their own bodies, and as Messiah gave His life for the congregation. So Messiah laid down His life. And so if you're married, in essence, the reason why a man is breathing is to make life good for his wife, and to lay down his life for her. Make sure that her needs are taken care of. What does the Torah say? The Torah says that the woman has a right that her needs are met.
And in my household, we joke that that's always, buying me more electronic equipment, computers and iPods and...
Or books.
Books, yeah. Or books on audio. Anything books or electronic related. But that's not quite what it means, even though I'd like to convince Tom of that whenever I have the opportunity. But, no, he doesn't, but he lets me believe my little...
He doesn't buy anything for you, does he?
He buys me a lot.
He doesn't buy anything from you, does he?
No. He lets me think he does, I think. I'm not going to turn around and see the look on his face, because I can just feel him back there. But we're to submit, but then it also says, husbands, love your wives as Messiah loves the church and gave himself up for her, so that... Now, this, what Eddie was talking about, is meeting the needs. You want to put a nice roof over her head. You want to make sure she has clothes to wear. You want to make sure she's got food, and then all of the physical needs are met. But these are the real needs of the wife.
Spiritual.
That he might sanctify her. This is what the husband's doing for the wife as Messiah does it for the church. Sanctify her. Cleanse her by the washing of the water of the Word. Present her in all of her glory. You know, that's why Sarah, you know, we joke, she was a hot babe. That's why Rivka was one of those hot babes. That's because they were presented in all of their glory, all of their inner beauty. It wasn't their outer physical beauty. That was there, and that was a given. But it was that inner glory that shined from within them. Present them in all of their glory without any spot or wrinkle or any such, that she would be holy and blameless. When the husband fulfills those needs, that's when things really start going. Because then the other things, you know, they're important, but you can live on a very little. You know, there are a lot of people in this world who think they need a really big house, and they need a lot of money, and they need all of these other things. But I look around at my girlfriends, and I see the ones that are the happiest usually don't have those things. But they have husbands that do this. And they live in small houses, and they don't shop at the best stores. But they have husbands who make them feel glorious and without spot and without wrinkle, and like they're the most important thing in the world.
You mean they don't feel like they have to go to Bueller's, or if you live in Cleveland, Heinen's, you know, really high-end kind of place. They feel okay going to Save-A-Lot or Aldi's or...
Hey, some of us shop...
Or
at the
Big Lots.
Or the roadside stand in Amish country, yeah? Or we grow our own. So, yeah, it's a matter of how you're treated by the one over you, whether it's your father or your husband, or if you're a child by your parents, is where you get your value. It's not the things that give you value. When you don't have this, when the wife doesn't have this from her husband, when the children don't have this from their parents, they have no value, so they have to fill that void with the things.
One more thing is, it says Ephesians 5:33, that the wife is to reverence her husband. As important as all the things that the husband does to the wife, it's also important that the wife reverence her husband. Liz.
Well, I'm going back a little bit to a scripture that I evidently understand in a different way maybe than all of you. Okay. It says, and be not drunk with wine, wherein is that stuff, but be filled with the Spirit. I understand that wine in you, period, is excess, because it says wherein is excess. Well, how can you be filled with the Spirit if wine is in there? And I speak from a family of alcoholism. I have seen nothing but degradation and damage done from alcohol. And if we're supposed to be like the 10 virgins, waiting and watching with our lamps lit for his return, how can we do that consciously, brightly, and whatever with alcohol in our system? I see no good to alcohol at all, and that's my opinion.
Martin? Thank you very much.
Anybody else?
Really? Thank
Bill?
You very much. That is a valid point.
It says right off the bat, it says, see then. And the see then is dealing because of what was said prior to it. In other words, we walk the walk that was taught, or we will become to naught. That's what's going to happen. If we don't walk the walk, we're just going to be as nothing. One other thing, because a lot of stuff was said, to deal with the part that says redeeming the time. I believe this deals with buying up for ourselves the seasonal time of good to ourselves and to other people, or the opportune time afforded us to work for Him. Now, what is the season of our good? I believe the season of our good starts whenever we accept Yeshua as personal Savior.
Correct.
Until we die. Or He calls us home, one or the other. I believe that's the time.
That's the season when you're supposed to be doing good works. That's what you were saved for. And so, yes, that is your season of good, absolutely.
Tom.
For the husband and marriage portion we were looking at, something that helps to understand this better is a better translation. Instead of having the word head in there, a better word would be originator. The husband, in verse 23, the husband is the originator of the wife, as Christ also is the originator of the church. We read it in our Western American mindset as boss, when actually it was originator. And of course, we're familiar that the husbands have the higher calling here, because we are commanded to love the wives, and the wives respect or reverence their husbands.
Okay, regarding Liz's comment, there is something that is mentioned on Pow Talk. That is why the priests in the temple were not allowed to drink wine while on duty. Anybody else have any thoughts, questions, comments? Thoughts, questions, comments? Go ahead.
I'm reminded of 1 Peter 3, where it says, verse 1, in the same way, wives, be subject to your own husbands, so that if any are disobedient to the word, they without a word might be won by the behavior of their wives, having seen your blameless behavior in fear. So there's something to say for doing right according to Yeshua or his word, even if your head or your originator doesn't always, you know, meet up with the word.
We are now in Ephesians chapter 5, verses 15 through 33. Does anybody else here in the congregation or in Pow Talk have any further thoughts, questions, comments regarding Ephesians chapter 5, verses 15 through 33? Revelation chapter 21, her domain is the New Jerusalem, created especially for her.
Is there enough room in New Jerusalem for everyone to have a mansion?
I'm sure there is. I don't think Yahweh gets in a situation where he didn't plan ahead and finds himself in a rough spot. Okay, anybody else with further thoughts, questions, comments regarding Ephesians chapter 5 or the other things that we discussed today? Anyone either here in the congregation or in Pow Talk land? Anybody else have anything? Well, if not, we'd like to thank you once again for participating with us on this triennial midrash of the scriptures for this week. We pray that something has been shared that's been a blessing to you, that's helped you in your walk, that's helped you to draw closer to Yeshua the Messiah. And until next week, when God willing we're able to do it again, we pray that you're blessed and shalom in Yeshua the Messiah. Amen.